Hello and welcome to Sip the Speech, the podcast for professionals in public finance. As many of you may know, last week was National Apprenticeship Week. We had a wonderful time here at Sip for sharing and celebrating the stories of our magnificent apprentices and the organisations that employ them. So we thought, why not keep it going? This week's episode is all about talent in the public sector. We spoke to members of the Sip for family from all points in their career, including trainee accountant Catherine Hodgkinson about apprenticeships, recently qualified accountant and Sip for Student Network Communications Officer Lauren Goff about her experience of working from home during COVID-19, as well as Sip for member Alston Owens on diversity in the public sector. But first up is Lauren with her experience of working from home during the pandemic. I'm here with Lauren Goff, a former Sip for apprentice, a newly qualified accountant and communications officer for the Sip for Student Network. Thank you very much for joining us today, Lauren.
Hi, thank you for having me.
No problem at all. So could you tell our listeners a little bit about your background, your role? Like I said, you're a recently qualified former apprentice. It'd be great to hear a bit about that and kind of the work that you do with the Sip for Student Network.
Gosh, I think 5 years ago now I graduated and I got my first job in a local government. I was working in property at the time. And from there, I thought this is what I'm really interested in. And I got a role then on a master's programme specialising in the public sector. And then I found the Sip for training programme. So I signed up for an apprenticeship with the London Borough Council and then spent the last 3 years working and studying there and got my qualification in the summer, which was great, a nice thing to happen in 2020. And then about 2 years ago, whilst doing my Sip for studies, I heard about the Sip for Student Network and I got involved regionally. So for the Southeast, I was a volunteer member helping to plan events. And from there, I also became a representative for the National Sip for Student Network. And I'm their first ever communications officer, which is nice because I get to implement lots of ideas. Anything I think could be helpful or interesting, it's up to me and I get to make it happen.
Sounds excellent. And congratulations on passing your apprenticeship in the summer. What's the feeling of being newly qualified, being a qualified accountant?
It's quite surreal because you get so stuck into the studying and the modules each term. And now there's no more of that. This is it. I'm finished. Obviously, there's still the CPD, but I am qualified and at work. I can say I'm an accountant, and that is quite daunting, but also it feels like a massive achievement whenever I can say it.
Oh, amazing. I mean, particularly in 2020, and it's been such a tough year for everybody. And as you say, it's nice to get some good news out of what was such a difficult year. So going into that and kind of your experience of doing your apprenticeship and studying and working during COVID, could you tell our listeners a little bit about what a sort of pre-COVID typical working day looked like for you?
It inevitably involved me running for a tube, up an escalator, for a train. Every single day, I know what time I had to get to work at. I know what time train I needed to catch to get there. And I could never leave the house on time or catch the right tube. So there's a lot of cardio and then going out at lunchtime with colleagues, getting a coffee, just going out for a walk together. And I think the key thing now when I look back is every working day I was sat in the middle of a finance team surrounded by people doing a similar job to you. And I never really appreciated it. Yeah, so that was like nearly every day. And then there'd be the college days as well, which I do really miss, you know, going into the Sip for office and seeing all the peers who were, you know, other apprentices or people studying and going through that shared experience. That was such a normal part of routine pre-COVID.
Sure, absolutely. I think quite a lot of people are kind of reflecting on the things that didn't really occur to them as things at the time. It just kind of gets absorbed into your life, and it's not really something you consider as a thing to think about, really, just being embedded in your team. So what's it been like balancing working and studying during the pandemic?
So there's two sides of the coin, really. In some ways, it made it easier because in that spring preparation for a June exam, there was no way I could distract myself. I couldn't go out. I couldn't make plans. I couldn't, you know, really procrastinate in those big ways. I was forced to stay inside and study. And I do think May 2020 didn't look particularly different to me from any other year because I'm that person who holds up the month before an exam and just gets stuck into the studying and the preparation. And especially because it's the final exam, that was definitely going to happen. But then it was harder because you couldn't go out as much. The lines all get blurred between when do you stop work and start studying, and then when do you feel like you're really on a break because the studying's in front of you and there's always more work to be done. And that was then the real challenge, was getting the balance between when to work, when to study, and also when to rest.
No, absolutely. I can imagine that being tough. So moving away from the studying element then, so on your day-to-day job and your role as part of your apprenticeship, and even once you, like once you've qualified past the summer over the course of 2020, would you say there were any particular challenges to COVID or working from home in a full-time capacity that were unique to kind of your role in public finance?
So where I was on a training scheme, I did annual rotations, and there's a lot of flexibility around people on these schemes. And so when COVID hit and everybody went to home, there was a lot of sickness and we found ourselves short staff producing account. And as I was that graduate trainee in a really flexible position, I got moved to support extra teams and help get work done. And that was a real challenge, trying to learn new things and do it all remote and take on that those responsibilities. It was a great opportunity. And that's one of the real merits of going through an apprenticeship program that might not have happened without COVID and definitely wouldn't have happened in this way, trying to pick it all up remotely and learn new things so quickly that are so time pressured.
Sure. So you touched a bit on the challenges and the difficulty with balancing the kind of where you take your breaks and the balance between home studying and work in a kind of working from home environment. Has there been anything about the environment that COVID has created that you've enjoyed? Has full-time working from home had any benefits? Has remote working changed anything for you in a positive way?
Absolutely. So I relocated from Yorkshire to London to do my SIPPA apprenticeship. You know, it was quite hard to get time to come home because I always had to be around to go to work and to go to college, to have to get special permission to work from my parents' house at Christmas. And I've been now at my parents' home for the last 3 months doing my job very effectively. And without COVID, I wouldn't have got this quality time now with them. And demonstrating, you know, working remotely wherever you are is exactly the same. So I'm really finding the positives and very grateful, sort of in a way, to COVID for letting me come home like this.
That's a really nice reflection. I think so many people are going to share that feeling, particularly young people who have travelled from other areas of the country to work in London. I imagine a lot of them will share the feeling you had and the difficulties that can be experienced when trying to get home for extended periods of time. So that's really lovely. So based around that, you talked about the fact that you've been able to do your role from home fairly effectively and that you're quite happy with how that has gone for you. Do you think that the way we work is set to permanently shift as a result of the pandemic? What's the kind of mood music that you're getting in your organisation on that front?
I think that the permanent shift was already happening, and what COVID has done is just accelerate it. Flexible, like hot desking, is something I've always known when I've been employed. And so, you know, we've been seeing hot desking increase, the flexibility ratios increasing. And now COVID's hit, we've been, you know, fast forwarded years from where I would have been otherwise. And all that culture change, getting people to feel comfortable working from home and having their teams working from home, I think it is set to stay. There'll be iterations to be done and, you know, fine tuning it, making sure it's working for everybody because everyone's circumstances are different. But I do believe it's a permanent shift that was already coming and now it's just here.
So based on that and the acceleration of what was already there, as you've described, what do you think, just personally, your ideal workplace of the future would look like?
I think that it would still involve like a physical office location to go to. But when I turn up there, I'm not going to be going to sit at a desk and work all day like we would have done previously. I'd like to see collaborative spaces. So when you go to the office, it's to get together with certain colleagues and, you know, really come together and be creative and be really productive and effective. And where we're already seeing this shift in those physical ways of working, my ideal kind of work of the future will see that flexibility also come in terms of when we work. So having, you know, still the same hours we worked each week, and there'll seem to be some sort of core elements that people can come together and still be around when they need to be talking to each other. But put flexibility in there. Some people are morning people. Some people work their best late in the evening. And I'd like to see that flexibility for myself, like ideally in the future.
Amazing. Lastly, and just to wrap up then, just touching on your role with the SIPPA Student Network, how would you say that COVID has kind of impacted the SIPPA Student Network over the last year? And if people are interested in getting involved, how can they find out more?
A lot of the volunteers haven't actually met each other now because of COVID. So the National Student Committee is made up of representatives from all different regions. And we've built these relationships virtually, but there's been an impact because, you know, normally we'd get together at a SIPPA conference and meet each other, and that feels missing. And it's been a big challenge around, we're used to organising physical events to help students and provide support to them. And it's now, how do we do that effective virtually? What are the opportunities there? How can we make the most of them? And there's been some great things we've found. So there's no location barriers now. We organised virtual revision events for the case study exam in December, and we were able to have three regions hosting those with open borders. So any student could sign up and dial in, whereas previously you would have been limited to, is your local region hosting that? And can you get to the location easily after work? Some regions, you know, cover massive distances. So it's affected us and it's made it a lot harder. But within that, there's a lot of opportunity for doing things differently, finding new ground. If you'd like to get involved, you can find us on Twitter at Sit for Students, and LinkedIn at Sit for Student Network. And you can always email us at csn@sitford.org.uk, and we can put you in touch with your regional network.
Amazing. Thank you very much, Lauren. And for any listeners, you will be able to find links to all of the places that Lauren has referenced in the description below. That's about all we've got time for today. So thank you very much to Lauren for joining us on this episode of the podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you again to Lauren for joining us this week. Next up, we talk apprenticeships with a trainee accountant from Lambeth and Hemant Baradia, Lambeth's Assistant Director of Finance.
I am Alison Kroll, and I'm here today with Catherine Hodgkinson, who is a trainee accountant at Lambeth Council, and Hemant Baradia, who is the Assistant Director of Finance at Lambeth Council. Thanks so much to both of you for joining us today. So, Catherine and Hemant are here to discuss their experience with SIPFA apprenticeships, both as an apprentice and as an employer. Catherine.
Yes.
What apprenticeship program are you undertaking with SIPFA, and what made you choose a career in public finance?
I'm completing the professional accounting qualification, which is a level 7 apprenticeship. I know there are two others, which are the level 3 assistant accountant qualification and the level 4, which is the professional accounting technician. Within the apprenticeship that I am doing, there are three levels to it. So you've got the professional certificate level, the diploma level, and the strategic level. And I'm currently working at the diploma level. I applied through the Finance the Future scheme, which recruits graduates over the different London authorities. And I decided to go into public finance. I'd come a slightly different route to a lot of the other trainees who have started out initially coming out of university. I was in a different role within a local authority. So since I've been about 16, I've worked in the public sector for different local authorities. And I'd always been interested in accounting, and I'd always wanted to work within the public sector. I am quite analytically minded. I like problem solving. So I just felt it was a really good fit for me.
Thank you. Hemant, could you tell us a bit about your organisation and why apprenticeships are important for you?
Hi, Alison. So the London Borough of Lambeth is one of the 14 inner London authorities out of the 33. We're quite a sizable geographic footprint. There's about 330,000 residents. We have 3,000 staff. We spend nearly £1 billion a year on 500 different services. If you were to compare us to another type of organisation, we would almost be a supermarket, a fairly sizable supermarket at that. So you can imagine the scale of the challenge that we have. For us, the apprenticeship scheme is critical to make sure that we're developing a professional cohort, particularly around finance and accounting and supporting the organisation to get value for money. The other thing the apprentice scheme does, it allows us to kind of extend the age and other diversity profile resets to make sure that we have a very good pipeline of new staff, and also that we have a retention and promotion record clearly sets out a career plan for apprentices. So for us, it's a very key staffing process that we kind of build into our systems.
My next question, I think, would be great for both of you to answer, but Catherine, if you could go first.
Yes.
Has there been any impact on your experience as a result of the pandemic? Are there any ways that you've had to adapt because of it?
Yes. From March, we've all been working from home. It's definitely been different, and it has taken a while to adapt, having previously had a few odd days here or there working from home to working from home throughout. We've adapted well. We've used Teams and all kept in touch with our colleagues, being able to do work jointly online has been really helpful. Having that technology in place has been really important. I think in terms of study, so when I was actually in face-to-face classes prior to the pandemic, and we were about three or four sessions in when the decision was to make face-to-face classes go remotely. So it took a bit of adjusting to that, and it does take time. And I think when you're at home and all of a sudden your workspace, your study space and your social space all become the same, it does take some adapting. But I think we've worked as best as we can. And I know there's been different things put in place to bring people together, even in terms of study, making sure all the students are communicating through the different messaging services online, making sure there's class contributions. So we've made it work.
Hamant, how have you had to adapt over the past year?
I think this has been one of our kind of bigger challenges. It sounds nice that people are allowed to work from home, but working from home permanently, as we have been for the last kind of 10 months, creates a different challenge, because the bits that you miss is around the social and culture of the office and that office environment. There's lots of things that happen that you kind of pick up on discussions and conversations. And I think this is the bit that we're still struggling with, to kind of how best to capture that and make sure that not just apprentices, but all of our staff get that kind of the organizational vibe. So we're putting in an extra effort into kind of the well-being of staff and mental health support, putting in specific connection pieces. So things like coffee mornings and drop-in sessions, and trying to encourage that social aspect, which is a bit of a challenge when you're doing it online. But hopefully, as we start to go through some of the changes, it is starting to become a bit more useful. But it is one that we want to kind of keep a clear eye on.
Right. Definitely something we can all relate to, all of these months stuck at home. What would you say are the benefits of participating in the SIPA apprenticeship program and in employing apprentices?
For us at Lambeth, this has been one of our key things. We've been part of the SIPA training program for the best part of 12, 13 years. Every year we've taken on graduate trainees. But in the last couple of years, as the apprentice program has come together in a more structured format, it has been critical to the way that we kind of bring in new resources and making sure that we've got a pipeline for future kind of promotions and retention. The apprentice program provides a structured development program. And part of that key thing is the extensive support put in place by SIPFA. It would be remiss of me to say that the levy, the apprentice levy that supports the funding is not helpful. So part of this is about how do we make the best use of the levy that we contribute towards to try and bring it back into the organisation to improve the opportunities for our workforce. The other thing I would say is that the apprentice programme isn't restricted by age. Traditionally, apprentices was the kind of thing that you did straight after school. But Catherine is a perfect example of somebody who's kind of had a chance to kind of go away and do something to kind of reset her kind of career path and kind of get involved in something that she's really keen on. That's why the apprentice program is a much more wider, and it is a proper support program around development. And that should be the focus.
Great, thanks. And Catherine, what would you say are some benefits of participating in the SIPFA apprenticeship?
I think it's amazing in terms of gaining skills. Within this program, we're on a rotation. So I'm on my second rotation now. So I've had experience in two different services, and the different skills that you're learning regarding that and the different areas that you're exposed to is brilliant, rather than just being in one role and getting that training and just being limited to that one particular service. So we are experiencing so much. It's on the job as well, which is great. So you having your study with SIPFA, and then you can go back into work and you can really solidify your learning by putting that into everyday practice.
Hamant, do you have any advice that you could provide to other employers who are maybe considering having apprentices come in?
As I've kind of said before, it is a key pipeline. It gives you enthusiastic, eager to learn, eager to develop, and eager to be part of your organization workforce. So that is a key piece of work there. As an employer, you need to make sure that you're ready to kind of bring these group of people on board and have a structured approach around the support that you can provide them, the opportunities that you can provide them, but also kind of think about the flexibility that this cohort bring you. As Catherine mentioned, there is rotations, there's opportunity to get involved in other programs. As an employer, it helps you structure a program for workforce development, and an apprenticeship should be viewed as part of that wider workforce development.
And Catherine, would you recommend a SIPFA apprenticeship to others just beginning their careers?
Absolutely. I feel that with this program, I've had a lot of support from employer to tutors. We also have work coaches, and they meet with us every 3 months, and our line manager, to see how we're getting on, whether we're meeting all of the skills, knowledge and behaviour that's required, so that they're keeping us on track. You get a lot of support from a lot of different areas to make sure that you're accessing the services and the support you need. If you're struggling, assisting you to meet those targets and to be able to achieve the things set out for you. So absolutely. I also think with SIPFA, it's public finance. So it trains you in terms of accountancy, but with the additional bonus of understanding how that relates in the public sector. There's always going to be a need for services within the public sector to meet the public need. So I think that is a real added bonus. I really do. I know with some other trainee schemes, they don't have day release, whereas we have that time where we're allowed to go during work time to our course. We study. It's not after work lectures that we need to go to. So that's really good that it's all incorporated.
Great. Well, thanks. Yeah, that was all really helpful and informative. Thanks so much for sharing your experience with us.
Last but not least, I caught up with SIPFA member Alston Owens. Alston was recently elected to the SIPFA Midlands Council and joined me to talk about diversity in public sector workplaces. So I'm here with Alston Owens, a SIPFA member. Thank you very much for joining us on the podcast today, Alston.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me. I'm excited to share my experience and thoughts.
It's been so great being able to get the perspective of members onto the podcast recently. We've had such a good response on social media, and there's such a range of stories to share. So thank you very much for joining us. Before we kind of go into the detail of what we were going to talk about today, can you tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, and tell our listeners a bit about the work that you've been doing around diversity and inclusion in the organisations that you work with?
For sure. So as you said, my name is Alston Owens. I'm married, father of two young girls. My parents are of Jamaican or backgrounds, from Jamaican Jamaican, so that would distinguish me as being black, or identify as black British. I think that's probably important in terms of some of the dialogue that I'm going to share with you. SIPFA accountant, a member of SIPFA in the Midlands Council, and as you've rightly alluded to, I take a special interest in diversity and inclusion. Started my career in the NHS in finance in the West Midlands, and I now work for Clarity Consulting Associates.
So as you said, you've recently joined the SIPFA Midlands Council and you have a particular interest in diversity and inclusion. So could you go into a little bit more detail about the sort of work that you've been doing in the diversity and inclusion space and kind of where your interests lie?
Yeah, sure. So this is a very topical subject. It's a high interest, I'd say, particularly in light of what happened in 2020. So the movement around Black Lives Matter, it's been given a high profile. At the inception of my career in the NHS, this has always been something I've taken an interest in, both personally and in my professional background. And it's just addressing, okay, when I came into the sector or NHS finance, the leadership looked a certain way. And I'm 10, 15 years in now. Improvements have been made, but I think we're still in that category where there's a certain group that is in a decision-making process. I could say it's the executive board, but I think it's not just the executive board, it's that senior leadership decision-making process. And I think there's something about how do we address that imbalance. And I think I'm fortunate in my current role and in the work that I do in the NHS that actually it's about challenging some of those leaders as to what can be done. This isn't about saying what's the answer or me indicating an answer, but having an open dialogue and conversation to bring the narrative to the table where we can just move it on in steps, as opposed to it being an agenda item, which we don't necessarily know what the right outcome should be.
So you touched on there what you saw when you came in your career and kind of what you're seeing now. So data still shows that women and individuals from ethnic minority groups are underrepresented in senior positions. So do you think it would be accurate to say that this pretty much reflects what you've seen in your career so far?
I guess the short answer is yes. So there's no surprises there. But I guess actually, let me put it into perspective. I'm a strong believer that the public sector in general, NHS, probably one of the best employers in the country and further afield. Some of the development programs that they offer, both around diversity and inclusion and the wider spectrum, aspiring director program, breaking through, these are all initiatives to spot talent, encourage talent, build upon existing skill sets into leadership roles are phenomenal, and they certainly work in, is clearly evidence to demonstrate how they work and the leaders that are in place now. But with all that, we still don't necessarily have those decision-making positions or exec roles with a diverse representation. They're not necessarily representing the communities they serve. They're not necessarily representing the workforce. The way I best put it is, if you know, I put my management consultancy hat on, you know, you put a business case together, demonstrate, well, what are the risks? What are the opportunities? What are we trying to demonstrate? And if there's a good investment on return, then clearly we're going to go straight ahead. I don't think around this particular initiative that the why is strong enough. I'm not too sure NHS or the public sector generally have a strong enough why. If it did, this wouldn't really be an issue. We'd be getting along, and whatever is perceived to be success would have happened.
In terms of that kind of movement towards success, obviously there are a lot of kind of moving parts to that. What would you say you see as the role of action and advocacy at the individual level?
For the individual, I think it's about bringing the discussion into your work environment, but making sure that actually this is not something that sits within HR. It's not compartmentalized within a certain sector. Actually, it's just across the board. So as an individual, there's an element of education that may or may not necessarily be needed. An example, so manager handling, GDPR training, these are all mandatory requirements, I think, as for NHS employees that when they come into the organization. I'm not too sure if diversity and inclusion is on that list. We know the reason why mandatory handling is important is evidence is that if you do this and have that training, you get an outcome, it reduces X. We know the reason why GDPR is important. Do we have a strong enough why as to why diversity inclusion training is important, and understanding, so now we've had the training, what does that mean? And I think that's probably important. And that probably does come down to individuals taking responsibility and saying, look, I'm lacking in this area of understanding and I need to learn a bit more. It's something I want to understand, to see the views of different people through their eyes.
So drawing on what you were saying there about the need for a strong why as part of the business case and the fact that you don't necessarily think that they fully have that yet, what do you think, moving past individuals, what more can employers be doing to make progress and develop the strength of that why?
So 2020, lots of activity to raising the profile of race inequality, addressing, you know, some of the challenges in diversity within senior leadership roles and in the workforce across the board. Multiple professions looked at, is it representative? Why are we not getting talent come through from different diverse backgrounds? And I'm pretty sure that most organizations, definitely in the public sector, will have some sort of anti-racism statement saying we support X, etc., etc. Now that's good, and we should be doing that. And I suspect many organizations may have done that before 2020. But I want to bring you to something that occurred in 2018. So this was Sarah J. Marsh. She is the chief exec of Birmingham Children's and Women's Hospital. She had reviewed her RES data, which is the workforce race equality standard. And I guess in short, I won't go through the whole detail. In short, the data was lacking. It was showing that there was a lack of representation within her organization. She took it upon herself to make a bold statement that for every senior appointment or interview panel that she was involved with, it had to be represented diversely. Now that speaks volumes to me. She made that statement. A, there was a backlash in terms of, well, is that the right direction of travel? It's not a given that every organization should take that type of action, but it does speak to the point of we need to move beyond the blanket statement on a website. And actually, there's a number of reasons why I think that particular movement or action may or may not work, and there's lots of things that you need to iron out the details, it has to work. But actually, they've trying to draw a line in the sand that says, look, we need to do something. I'm a, you know, a strong believer that there are many organizations out there who are passionate about diversity and inclusion, but they're almost stuck. And I call it paralysis by analysis. They have all this data, pie charts and line graphs demonstrating where this is where your white colleagues sit and this is where Black and BME staff sit. And it's almost in the too hard to do box. And then we move on. And I think what, and I'll say her name, Sarah J. Martin, is actually we need to do something, and the detail we can figure out. I guess the question is, how do we move on, yeah, beyond that? Not every organization is going to take that type of action. But what I do know, So, you know, another example, 18 months ago, I would be doing work around business case for virtual consultations to see actually, again, does it make sense to see patients in some sort of capacity via an arrangement like we're doing now via Zoom or MS Teams in that capacity. And again, we'd weigh up the cost, understand the risks, understand what the opportunities are. And then was like a resounding, no, risk too high. Yet last year, those same decisions were made overnight. Again, going back to the why was important. It was overwhelmingly important that this is the direction travel now needs to take. Are we going to go back to, you know, how we've done things before in a kind of not using video consultations? No, there's definitely some things to work out, but we'll work them out. The issue around diversity and inclusion should be treated exactly the same. You do need to understand the data and what it's telling you. But it's also important to actually demonstrate this is an organization that we want to represent and we want to be inclusive. We want to have an organization that's embracive of all the people that come to work for it. And I think by making that statement, that action, it reverberates the type of organization and values that's represented. And that's quite powerful. Now, I think there's like a maturity matrix in terms of the space that you want to work in and things that you want to do. All organizations have to have that kind of self-assessment of where they are, how is it being embedded in their organizations, and try and build a roadmap, dare I say it, as to what where they are now to what they want to go to.
So you touched there on the role of the individual, the role of employers, and I think that paralysis by analysis point is particularly poignant. I think a lot that's going to resonate with quite a lot of our listeners. What role do you think there is for SIPFA to play as the professional body, specifically for this issue in public finance?
So I'm really encouraged that SIPFA are doing a lot already. As an overarching strapline, I think it's important that SIPFA shed a light on best practice. Example, Birmingham City Council have just adopted an accountability framework called the Race Equality Code. As you can imagine, it is looking at the issue around race inequality. This is a provision, this is a document that lists 51 provisions. I'm interested to hear what comes out of that, how they get on. And I think SIPFA are acutely aligned to take best practice in one organisation and actually share it with another. So that it's health, local authority, police, housing association. And I would struggle to see an organization that say this isn't an issue. SIPFA, again, in the position that members hold within finance directors, this is where the resources for decision making power happens. And I think it's just a key role in terms of understanding actually have we got a grip of this? A, within its own finance department teams, but also what's the organization doing? So that's powerful. So I listened to the podcast with the chief exec of the Bridge Group, Nick Miller, and the work that they're doing and Access to Accountant. And it was a consistent nodding of the head. And I agree with Nick. It's really powerful in terms of how they're delving into the detail of why this issue is where it is, where we are today. And I think that's really powerful. So that's just bringing light to that and sharing that with members within regions and events. There's some work that SIPFA in the Midlands are doing around mentoring and coaching, and that's powerful in terms of bringing on the next tier of leaders. I think there's something specific which SIPFA can do around supporting the pipeline of future leaders. So our accountants are training right now. Where are those accountants coming from? Have we got the right pipeline coming through? Is it representative of all backgrounds? I think another program which I'm fascinated by, 10,000 black interns. I wouldn't want to elaborate any more than that, because I think it speaks for itself. It's a program that's trying to create 10,000 black interns across all sectors. And I think SIPFA have a good role to play in terms of supporting that organization. And then I think it's just ultimately about having a wider dialogue and having an open dialogue. All too often, the conversation of diversity and inclusion can be an uncomfortable one, and it can cause for uncomfortable silences. And I think we need to move beyond that. I'm almost certain that that's part and parcel of the journey. And that's probably prerequisite for change. Yes, we can have the uncomfortable dialogues now, but we can't continue to have it because it's in the too hard to do box.
So as a kind of wrapping up question, I suppose, bringing all of that together, and obviously you talked at the beginning of this conversation around the Black Lives Matter movement in 2020 being a particular tinderbox spark for a lot of activity in 2020. Do you think that there is true momentum for change in the sector as a whole, and how do we kind of keep that momentum going?
Again, the short answer is absolutely yes. So there's certainly momentum. 100% people are listening. Doors are open. If I see that in the organizations I talk to, absolutely. I think what's missing is, okay, what do we do? Okay, yep, you've got my ear, Alston. I am 100% on board. now what? I definitely don't have all the answers, but I'm definitely encouraged and motivated to talk to people to start to understand what a potential answer solution could be. But it is something about understanding where you are now. Clearly, there'll be some organisations, NHS, local authority, that are leaps ahead of their counterparts and colleagues. And it's understanding that foundation. So where are we now? What does that mean? Are we good, bad, indifferent? Okay, we now know where we are. We've got a mature conversation going on. Let's take some action. And if there isn't immediate action, actually, what are the things that we're challenged against that we're going to make a bold step to move that forward? And that's important. I think there's another step, having a key set of indicators. I'm a strong believer that what gets measured gets delivered. What happens in 6 months from now when this doesn't happen? What happens from 12 months from now? Because then you're almost holding yourself to account. And I think lastly, there's something about education, whether that be for the individual, for the teams, or for the organization. There should be a theme which, you know, runs through all of what I've just said about, you know, why are we doing this, and building a strong case to demonstrating what success looks like. Is it better for patient outcome? Is it better for the workforce? Does it breed diversity in thought? And if it does, then actually that's the direction that we want to go for. I know that there's been great strides made in the last 12 months and we're moving certainly in the right direction, but I think we're on a journey. I think there's more work to do.
Amazing. Thank you very much, Alistair. You've provided some really interesting and quite challenging food for thought there, but I'm glad to hear you're kind of feeling positive and optimistic about the direction of travel. So thank you very much for joining us on the podcast today, and we really hope we'll be able to welcome you back soon to kind of talk about this issue again.
Absolutely. I really appreciate it. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Sit for Speaks. Thank you again to Alston for sharing his thoughts, and to all of our guests for joining us on today's episode. That about wraps it up for now. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again next time.